Hello everyone, I'm Rob Warner.
And I'm Elliot Jackson.
And this is Just Ride from Red Bull. Let's go.
Yeah, I've got the itch to do it again, but...
Here we go.
I really remember coming off the road gap on the race day and hearing a crowd and thinking, I haven't. That is a noise that I haven't heard for so long. I haven't done that for 5 years. And I always said to him, I'd love to do YouTube, but I wouldn't know what to talk about. I'd just ride my bike. and he came to my compound. He was like, what are you talking about? You wouldn't know what to talk about. He's like, this isn't a slopestyle compound. This is a film set. So we've got three horses, three peacocks, chickens, a dog. It's mad.
What?
Yeah. It's every day is insane.
Hello and welcome to episode 5 of series 2 of Just Ride. I'm Rob Warner and I'm alongside this man. You're supposed to say Elliot Jackson at that point.
Well, I thought you were going to say Elliot Jackson normally. You can tell that we haven't worked in what, 2 weeks or something like that.
We've had a couple of days off and everything's gone a bit Pete Tong. Everything's gone pear shaped. All right, let's go again. This is Just Ride, episode 5.
No way. We're in.
Are we in? Now?
We're already
all
in.
Right, mate.
Yeah, we're
all
already
right.
in.
All right.
We're already
all
in.
Right, we're in.
What have you what have you been doing? You've been riding a lot?
I feel like I've been making up for lost time because we had a hectic first quarter of the year, 28 flights, I think I did, most of them long haul. So, and I have missed riding, although you would be better in a submarine here in the UK. But it is drying up now. It is the evenings, the clocks have changed, the highlight of the year for me. It's light till nearly 6 p.m. and I can get out of my bike a little bit later. So it's all good, mate. It's all good. I mean, I'm all right. Yeah, riding bikes is the best, isn't it? That's what we do.
I love it.
And I know you're been here, right? So for all those people who think that Elliot Jackson isn't a mountain bike rider and didn't race the World Cup and is one of the most quote-unquote stylish riders of all time, he is about to get back on a bike and do a riding edit. Have you done it yet or not? Oh, his mouth's wide open.
Goodness.
What's happened?
Yeah,
what's
okay.
happening? He hasn't been on a bike for a while.
Now I feel like it's like one of those things where you have it on your calendar and you're like X-ing out the days as it gets closer. Because since we did have some time at home, I feel like I'm almost like, not quite, this is an exaggeration, but like I'm back into race mode. Like I have this little ski machine that you pull down on these handles. And so I've been like, I've been doing like workouts. It's like a Rocky, you know, like a montage, like, and then I've been like out riding, you know, but yeah, it's coming up. So we go to Vancouver Island, I think.
Oh, not Mount Prevot.
I hope not.
Yeah,
I don't know if I'm ready for that.
No. They took me
Mark
there.
Mark Wallace, Stevie Smith.
They took me there and Mark Wallace dropped into this chute that I thought was unrideable. He did it at about sort of 40 miles an hour. I was like, right, here we go then. Yeah, actually later that day, I destroyed my shoulder and the rest of the series wasn't quite the same. That was back a few years ago on Rob Meets. But yeah,
funny.
I hit a stump so hard, I pretty much destroyed both shoulders. In one sort, yeah. Yeah, Mount Prevot.
I don't know how do you destroy both shoulders without destroying your head? I don't know.
Just the impact on two already very worn shoulders started the impingements that I fight to this day, actually. I have to do it, since that accident, I have to do shoulder exercises every day or I'm woken up at night in pain.
Wow.
Yeah, but it's not that crash. It was like, it's the 50 years of riding bikes. 40 years, 43 now.
if the next intro is Rob saying, well, Elliot's actually out on this one.
You'll know why.
Then you know what happened.
Are you excited though? Because are you on a downhill bike? That it sounds like it. And it's a riding edit. I mean, I don't want to stress you out, Elliot, but there is nowhere to hide on a riding edit, which is why I will never do them, ever. I have to have a storyline, a lot of chat, just to ride. You've got to be top notch, man.
here we go. Okay, so after this, I need to get out of here quickly because I need to go back and train. So
that
I
can... needs to get on that indoor ski machine again.
Yeah, so you know where I will have gone.
Hospital.
One thing.
the emergency room.
Okay,
that's where you'll find. That's where you'll find him.
Okay, but one thing that is going to come up, and I'm looking forward to it coming up, so I can show you my skills and beat you at biking or something
and
like that.
And you will. I'm only taking the mick. I am actually. Do you know what? I commentated on you a little bit when you at the World Cups, but
yeah, that's right.
But I've never seen you really ride in your. At your best. So I genuinely can't wait to see this, mate. You come from motocross. I know you got it. It's going to be good. I can't wait. Honestly.
I know.
I'm excited to see you ride.
Oh, okay. There's too many things. I'm going to have to bring it in on another episode. There's a hidden talent that Rob has. But yeah, so we're going to Sea Otter, which is this festival in Monterey in Northern California. And it's got a bit of everything. It's at this this car track called Laguna Seca. It's one of like the most famous American raceways for automobiles, cars, and it's all these different disciplines. So they have road, they have gravel, they have mountain bike, like they have slalom. It's probably the like premier slalom race in the world. Downhill, all of these things. It's not the best courses that you would have ever had, but it's this cool moment where you know, you have, you know, these big road stars, you have the big mountain bike stars, you have all the companies there, big kind of vendors and trade show as well. So, Rob, I don't think you've been there for, I don't even know.
Don't say.
A long time. Right?
A long time. Let's just leave it at that. I went there when I signed for Giant. I reckon it was the last, when I just signed for Giant in 1996. And I actually think that was probably, I don't think I've been since. I don't think it's a...
Wow.
And it's a huge thing now, right? Hundreds of thousands of people and...
Yeah, it's super big and it's funny because I don't know if I've missed one.
Oh.
Like it was the first race. So it was the race that I won in Cat 2 and it allowed me to get my pro license.
What?
Which allowed me to later on that year race my first World Cup. And... contrary to popular belief, Aaron Gwynn wasn't the only one who did some amazing things with no chain. Went to Val de Sole, lost my chain, and qualified 75th.
Oh my god!
But yeah, so we're going together. We're going to be at Sea Otter together, do some riding and stuff like that. So if you're there, make sure you come and say hi.
Yeah.
And we'll love to talk. All things podcast, or at least I do, because I love podcasts. I think I've got Rob on the train now that we're in episode 5, season 2.
You're right. I slowly warmed up, and now I absolutely love them. What's more fun than chatting to people about the mad stuff they get up to? Yeah, it's brilliant. It's brilliant.
Rob, I feel like that's the perfect segue because we've had so many of these incredible emails from the Just Ride community. This one actually was one of my favorites. Rachel Gittins said, "Just Ride is my new favorite pod. I've been crushing through the episodes and can listen to you guys, Elliot giggling and Rob yelling in pure stokement all day." I love that word. That's a new word. Thank you, Rachel. She also suggested a few guests for us, including the incredible Lael Wilcox, who will be on the show in 2 weeks' time. So thank you, Rachel.
Amazing. And we also had this great email from Adam Adele. "Dear Rob and Elliot, first off, I'd like to say how much we enjoyed seeing you guys present Red Bull Hardline Australia. 100% worth getting up for at 7 a.m. for the live broadcast. A total nostalgic vibe." So, well, thank you very much for that. And to be honest, there is nothing. Well, I don't know about you, Elliot, but for me, the day of a live broadcast of a big downhill race still beats all for me. He's gone on to say, "I've discovered the Just Ride podcast. And I'm a massive fan of your work. It's helped quickly pass lots of Zwift racing and has inspired me beyond doubt. So thanks for getting in touch, Adam. And of course, if you want to email us, then hit up podcast@redbull.com. Yeah, all good. Thanks very much. And before we get on today's show, I wanted to shout out about something new. Just Ride listeners will want to watch. Race Tapes has just debuted on Red Bull TV. It's a six-part TV series that is behind the scenes. It delves deeper into the wildest stories from the world of elite mountain bike racing from the World Cup. The show follows the incredible tales from the 2023 Downhill World Cups, and it's the perfect show to whet your appetite ahead of the season, the 24 season that kicks off in Brazil this weekend, so don't miss that. All six episodes are now live on Red Bull TV. You can check them out all at once. You can binge watch them, and you'll even get to see Elliot's pretty face.
Oh, man. I love me some downhill.
I actually thought you were literally going to say, I love me. And leave it at that. I was like, wow, bold, what an intro.
That's really funny. That's so good. Okay, enough about us.
True.
Let's get on to the day's show. We have the famous Matt Jones. Can't wait for this one.
A man who is very much living his best life. So today's guest is one of the most instantly recognisable mountain bike riders on the planet. He started out as a slopestyle rider, competed at the very highest level before moving into filming projects with Red Bull and then ultimately creating one of the world's biggest biking YouTube channel. It is Matt Jones. Happy with that intro, Matt?
That was fabulous. Can you follow me around doing that everywhere I go?
With some sort of, yeah, with a fanfare.
When I walk into a restaurant, you go in 20 seconds before and tell everyone that.
I love it. Matt, I mean, Rob gave intro. You a pretty good intro, but how would you describe yourself?
Jack of all trades. I don't really know. I've done a lot of things. I started off, I'm a professional mountain bike rider. I do a lot of YouTube now. I wouldn't say I'm a YouTuber. That's just an extension of me riding my bike and wanting to show people how I do it, where I do it. But I think I'm hard to categorize. So maybe that's what today's going to be about, getting to the bottom of it.
Let's categorize.
I need a label.
Let's put you in a really small box.
Downhiller nowadays.
So Matt, you burst onto the scene in the UK while you were still in school when you were 18. It was 2013. Had that always been the dream to kind of be on the world stage in mountain biking, slope style?
Yes and no. I think I became a professional mountain biker by accident because when I was at school, I watched a lot of mountain bike movies like New World Disorder and things like that. And I loved it. Like, I adored the idea of riding my bike on all these cool jumps, all these pro riders, but there was no evidence that it was a career. So I didn't really understand how you bridge that gap from riding in your local woods to suddenly being in the mountain bike movies. And therefore I didn't really go after it, but I loved riding the same jumps. I loved digging too. We should talk about that today. I'm obsessed with digging and building jumps. Like, that's a form of art, I think. And then got to the end of school, was going to go to university and be a mechanical engineer, which is a real career. Like, my teachers reminded me of that a lot of times, that that's a career mountain biking isn't. But then I did all right at some competitions, got sponsors, and then looked up and somehow it was my job. So now there's plenty of evidence, isn't there, for youngsters that sport, action sports, extreme sports, there's a future for it. But I think I was at that time, that pivotal time, where there wasn't any, but got lucky. Yeah.
Did you grow up then on mountain bikes, Matt? Like, I mean, I come from downhill and I can see the sort of pathway at the downhill. You ride bikes fast, you end up racing downhill. But like, how on earth do you become one of the world's best slopestyle riders? Because it is so incredibly specialist. Like, it's absolutely out there on its own. For me, it's it's something so different.
Yeah, it's a good question. 15 years ago, it was more obscure too, because no one had slopestyle compounds or like setups or airbags to train for a slopestyle event. I like dirt jumps has always been a thing though, like way back, whether it be BMX, mountain bikes, 24-inch, 26-inch, dirt jumps has been a thing. That's what I fell in love with.
And that's your way in, isn't it, I suppose, really?
My local trails, Woburn, has 20-second downhill runs, which was fun. And somehow my brother got from that to racing World Cups.
Yeah.
My brother Jono. But they had really good dirt jumps and I loved building them as much as I liked riding them. And I guess if you've combined the love of building jumps with like quite a relentless work ethic, you're going to build a environment to get good at doing tricks. That's naturally what happens, especially when the landings are made of sand and they're soft. I mean, that was brilliant. So I started doing tricks. I learned to do a backflip, 360, things like that. And then in that year off I spoke about, I went to some slopestyle competitions, which are just big dirt jumps. It was what I was doing, but way bigger, wooden features, not dirt features. But it was much the same, just way bigger and more airtime. But the mad thing was back then, for those few years, and it wasn't just me, all the riders that rode dirt jumps that were doing slopestyle comps had to learn how to ride slopestyle courses at slopestyle events. You can't practice them at home. With downhill racers, they just practice going fast on a bike. Then they go to a different track and they just go fast on their bike.
Yeah.
We had to ride whale tails, flat drops, step downs, boner logs, wall rides. No one has that in the woods.
No. Well,
Matt, give us a little overview of like what those things are. Explain what a slopestyle course is to the best of your ability.
Right, okay. It's always under 60 seconds and it's a combination of feet built on riding downhill to just allow riders to go as high as they can in the air, launch yourself in the air to do tricks. And you got to do creative tricks in different directions and combine a run together that gets a load of points. So dirt jumps, steep takeoff, steep landing, you're only going to be able to produce similar tricks. So then slopestyle events said, like, okay, let's start the riders up on a big scaffolding structure and they can ride off the end of that, like riding off a house. Then you land on a landing with all that speed, you go around a berm, then you can have a big step up. That's going to be a different trick. Then let's put a wall ride in and see if anyone can trick off of that. Then a whale tail's like an in and out feature. It's just about being creative. And it allowed people to invent tricks and put runs together that became more and more interesting. But we all had to learn how to ride those features in Switzerland or America or Germany, yeah, when they've built one for you. So that was quite fun. Like, I remember my first time trying to 360 a flat drop was in Canada, and I had to do it like the day before finals. Whereas now, I've got a slopestyle compound, all the pros have got them, you're learning all that stuff at home to take to comps. But it was quite cool back then, it was pioneering it.
Yeah, and I mean, you, like the young kids now, you mentioned slopestyle compound, a lot of the kids have airbags and foam pits and things too to learn on.
Has that made the rate of progression since your early days noticeably more these nowadays? You know, the airbag,
unbelievable. You can fast track. So I guess it took 10 years for tricks like a flat drop backflip, like Sam Pilgrim did the first flat drop backflip, double backflips, all of those tricks to exist. Because to learn to double backflip, you first have to learn to jump, then backflip, then get good enough at backflipping that you can do it on a massive jump, a jump big enough for two rotations, and then you've got to send that. And if you land on your head, you're out for 6 months, and then you might get the chance to try again. Now, you could probably...
be out forever.
Yeah, true. You could cram all that into a week now. You could send someone off an airbag, even if they're not very good at biking, and teach them how to backflip, because you can land on your head now. So that's made it easier to progress, but a way harder landscape to become professional.
Yeah, because there's more people at it. That's right.
Yeah, it's actually safer.
It's safer. There's less risk attached. Yeah, it's mad that I hadn't thought of that, right? Yeah, so the sport's grown then with the advent of these aids.
Yeah, and those aids aren't always private. Lots of bike parks have big airbags, foam pits. Some people are lucky to live close, some are unlucky, but it's out there. It's feasible. You can... you could definitely at the age of 10 now say, I want to be a slopestyle rider and get all the pieces of the puzzle in place to get there.
Yeah.
And Matt, one of the things that I've always wondered looking in from the outside is just how it's judged. I mean, I think we all talk about judge sports and things like that. Like, could you explain kind of in a bit of detail what the judging process is, what the judges look for, and maybe what kind of rider you were?
Okay. God, it's hard to answer, but I'm actually well up for answering it. So it's all based on what tricks you do. You're riding against yourself, not against anyone else. You're the only rider on course. So you need to produce a run that's easy on the eye, that's nice to watch, that makes you want to shout, stand up, like, oh, that was sick. You want to, like, please the crowd, really. It's quite, like, almost Roman-esque. It's ancient, isn't it? So it's showing off. We all get to show off for a living. But I think it's judged on the difficulty of your tricks. Now, the judges, even if they've never seen it before, and you bring something new to the table, they'll say, he's the only one doing that. That's unbelievably hard. There's points for that. It's also how well you execute it. You have to land well. You have to land perfectly at the top of the landing, almost like you're not bending your legs. You can't slip your feet off the pedals. It has to look clean and effortless, which is difficult to do when you're doing something insanely hard. You even get marked down for pedaling between features, because pedaling is a sign of you've lost speed. You've messed up a little bit. You need to get that speed back, because these courses are built generally so you can ride top to bottom without pedaling at all. So effortless ease in an insane difficulty and amplitude. You want to go higher than everyone else, which is possible. But I'd say the way it's judged now is you actually only really marked down. I feel like, which is a good thing, I feel like you start your run at 100% and they're looking for ways to knock you down. Whereas some sports would be like all about building you up. It's like adding points. Right. I think that's actually quite an interesting way of judging, because they're really, really critical on errors. It's all about perfection now. And that deters people from trying unbelievable stuff. I did quite like watching the movies years and years ago where people would just try obscene things that weren't even possible in a competition, and they might even get on the podium for it because they're rewarded for being mental. Whereas now, like, you could do the run of your life, which would have smashed everyone, but if both feet come off the pedals on the last jump, you're not going to win. And there's a sad side to that, but it's an elite sport. It's professional. I can understand why.
Yeah, it's become more and more professional, isn't it? That's how it is.
When I was growing up, the person I looked up to, like the local British dirt jump rider, is called Glenn Coe. He, at the NEC show in Birmingham, when I was really, really young, tried a double backflip on a jump, chainring the landing, so didn't even make the gap, snapped his bike in half, like the forks and handlebars came clean off. He like rolled down the landing, stood up, arms up. He won. They gave him first place for that.
Oh my God. How cool is that?
That's how much it's changed.
Yeah.
Is that what you try to do in your runs? Actually, answer that, and I would love to know if you remember your greatest run of all time, like one that really stands out to you in your career.
The best feeling was the first time I ever got down to the finish line at Crankworx Whistler, Red Bull Joyride, into that finish area with like 50,000 people on the hill. I think I only came eighth, but I've got a bit of a more complex story with the top slopestyle competitions. It actually took me forever. It took me 3 years to land a run, and there's like three of them a year. So it took me almost 10 Crankworx stops to actually land a run and get to the finish. I made
and so
a habit
just
of
crashed every time, or
crashed or blew up tires.
What? So it literally took you 3 years of Crankworx before you finished the run you were trying to do.
Yeah, and there was where I'd on the last jump, I often crashed on the last jump too, which is more frustrating. It was all there's runs where I would have got on the podium, I think, and then things went wrong, or I crashed and I made a habit of hitting my head. I've had quite a lot of concussions, so my best run, that was my best feeling run, but the ones where I won, which is Swatch Rocket Air in Switzerland and another one in Colorado, they were the best, because it just felt like the coming together of everything, all the tricks I'd been working on at home, all the ones I'd learnt at competitions, all the ones I've been trying more recently. I could just, the course was perfect, the conditions are perfect, and it was like bang, 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 ticking off things. That's such a rad feeling, dropping in, and as soon as you've gone off the first drop and done a trick, like a flat drop backflip, that's out the way, done, box tick. Then you're like bombing into the next jump, double backflip, landed that, sweet. It's a cool feeling working your way down a competition run. You can see why people want to stay doing it as long as they can.
Why did you step away from it? And have you found anything now that can, like the way you talk about it, you sound like you love it. Do you miss that intensity of that? I felt like I was on the bike as you were explaining it.
Yeah, yeah, I've got the itch to do it again, but
here we go.
Yeah, well, I've said that for a few years. It's such a cool tour and such a cool feeling, and you get to ride with your best mates. You're never against them. Like, you're only ever doing the best you can. There's no possible way that someone can hinder your performance. Like, you're just riding against yourself, so you can only ever hate yourself.
Come back. We want to see it.
Yeah, I do. I miss it. You asked me if I miss it. I definitely miss it. But I had a streak of bad luck. I never won a Crankworx, and that's okay. It was my goal to podium at one. The concussions was a nuisance. Like, that's definitely more and more evidence now that you should try and avoid whacking your head as much as you can. I seemed pretty good at it. But I as much as I looked up and I think it's because I looked up and mountain biking was my career by accident. So I felt like a bit of an imposter doing all these big these slopestyle competitions. I never even meant to get there and loved it for a few years. But then I became quite obsessed with all the other parts of the industry, and even that's doing film projects. So I had this amazing thing with Red Bull. Red Bull sponsored me to be a slopestyle rider. And then I got the chance 7 years ago to do that big film Frames of Mind. And that unlocked so much creativity in my mind, which I think's always been there back from when I used to dig jumps in the woods. I got the chance to design and build a course and create tricks to do on those features. That is actually who I am. And then I thought, well, I don't get to do that at slopestyle competitions because everyone rides the same course and it's not always, you can't always be 100% creative. And then I never looked back.
And that was it. That's kind of, so you slipped away from slopestyle rather than it was a decision to walk away from it then, really. It was like you got into other things that ticked your boxes more.
Yeah, it's true. I never actually decided to retire from it. It was never, I guess, again, looked up and I wasn't doing it anymore. I think maybe I fell out of the points and needed to get back in. But during that year, just did filming, started YouTube. I mean, that's changed everything for me. I spend so much time doing stuff like, YouTube.
I was going to say, you still ride, a high level. And obviously YouTube is full of that. Your YouTube is full of that. But would you be realistically now, it's been a while since you competed at the top level of slopestyle. Would you be able to get back there now? Would you be confident you could get back to that level? I guess you haven't got all those tricks in the bag at the moment.
No, I could get all my tricks back, but then I'd have to learn a lot of new ones.
Yeah.
If I'm being really honest, I know for a fact I could get back into the top 14 in the world, and that's who gets invited to Crankworx. I 100% believe I could be on that list. I don't think I could get on the podium. And if I could, I'm quite a relentless person and I work hard. Yeah. But to do that, I'd have to put 100% into that category, into that box. And then, again, I'd have to press pause on all the other things I've built, which is YouTube, all the fun projects I get to do with Red Bull, the gigs that you and I do, Rob, where we've done commentary and things like that, would all end.
The clothing business, things like that would probably all slide a little bit, mate, wouldn't they? And they're all reliant.
They'd stop.
Well, everything, because everything really, your YouTube now is the backbone of your career, isn't it? That's fair to say.
Well, let's get into the other things that you do, because you do so many other things. I mean, you started that YouTube channel 7 years ago. It's got over 750,000 subscribers, and I mean, it's growing. I know you kind of said that you slipped out of slopestyle, or to use your words, Rob. Was there a plan coming in? I know you said you are such a relentless person. Did you plan on having this incredibly popular YouTube channel when you first started?
Well, I didn't know. I rode with a guy called Harry Main quite a lot, who's a pro BMX rider, who was one of the first guys to really push YouTube in BMX and mountain biking. And I always said to him, I'd love to do YouTube, but I wouldn't know what to talk about. I mean, I just ride my bike. He came to my compound, my slopestyle compound, where I had an airbag, slopestyle jumps. And I was saying this to him, and he said, what are you talking about? You wouldn't know what to talk about. He's like, this isn't a slopestyle compound. This is a film set. He's like, you own a studio. You have a filming studio. You can do whatever you want here. And then it reframed the whole thing. And I thought, it's not about always just taking people riding with you. It's so much more to that. It's storytelling. And
could be anything you want.
Yeah, because I like being creative and building jumps. And a lot of my YouTube videos are building jumps, building features, riding. It's perfect for me. I'm so lucky. I absolutely love it. It's such a cool platform to express yourself and do things you love. And if you can inspire people off the back of that, then even better.
If you can make it work like you do, then to me, it feels like it would be absolute freedom. You're not tied to anything except your YouTube, which is what you're fully in control of. And that must be pretty liberating. You know what I mean? There's no one on the end of the phone telling you to go here, there, or anywhere else. You are totally in charge of your mountain bike career now.
Yeah, it's awesome. Yeah, I definitely steer the ship. And a lot's changed. I mean, everything else now, all my brand deals, sponsorship stuff, all the opportunities that I find along the way, I think a satellite to the YouTube being at the centre. I think that is that's my platform that I can offer to the world, to the audience, and to brands that want to support me. And that's absolutely central to that whole thing, and everything else orbits that. So it's pretty cool. And interestingly, I got going with it quite early on when all the other mountain bikers were like super against it. They were trying to make life
right.
hard.
I remember that. Yeah. It was really low status.
Yeah, people like Bernard, Brendog. I remember filming videos down in Surrey, and they were shouting stuff in the background to make it difficult to film, to edit. They're like, YouTube's rubbish. What are you playing at? 2 years later, they're queuing up with their GoPros to make YouTube videos.
So,
yeah, and I've got more subscribers than them, so they missed the boat.
Matt, I want to. You have a very unique perspective, and I think you're one of the more deliberate people in the cycling world. So I kind of want to dig into a little bit of how you think about content creators, and you mentioned the business aspect of it. Give me an overview of what it's like to be a content creator. Let's start there. Would you call yourself that?
It's definitely a big part of what I do. Yeah. What's it like? It's so unbelievably wide open. Sometimes it's like so confusing. Like, imagine someone said to you, tomorrow you need to wake up and go and make a video, and it can be whatever you want. Just make sure it's good. That's such a tricky thing when it's so broad and open to actually come up with an idea in that space. Usually someone, if you work for a company or do anything, you're working with inside parameters, aren't you? You know, I'd like you to design an extension for my house, or can you build a part to fit this airplane? You're just being told, just do something. Get up tomorrow and do something. Do something good. So that's interesting. So the whole coming up with ideas is step one, isn't it? If you can't do that.
And it's a big pressure, really, because you do, what, 2 or 3 YouTubes a week? I mean, like, that requires... I mean, I've played at it in your level, but it's hard. It's really difficult to think of, I found, to do things to keep that bubble rolling. Like,
yeah, it is. But I'm lucky that I love building jumps. I've always fallen in love with building jumps, and that's, if you rent some land and start digging there, you've got 25 videos. So that's where I've survived the test of time, I think, and not burnt out and not dried up with content ideas as a content creator, as you say, Elliot, is investing in series, really. I've done a lot of series, which...
Well, I was going to ask you, because there was something I did want to ask. You don't have to answer this, but your backyard build you did in the COVID lockdown, you know, all the jumps down the garden there. There was a lot of rumours about that from all the other mountain bikers who'd probably poo-pooed YouTube, but people said you made literally millions of pounds out of people, YouTubers, watching your videos during the COVID lockdown era, because it did blow up that series. But you don't have to answer, but was there millions of pounds involved? Because we're talking big numbers, weren't we?
No, I wish I could sit here and go like, yeah, dude, and then like lift up with 3 Rolexes on.
I've got a McLaren.
Yeah, true. But it wasn't from digging up my garden then, that's for sure. Lockdown for me was insane. I'd just like had a garden, and I decided I was going to build 2 bumps and a takeoff, and filmed it, and it got more views than I'd had in the last 2 years. And I realised everyone was sat at home, probably wanting to do the same thing. And I was so lucky that I could legitimately do that at home. And I dug every single day for 100 days with a shovel. 100
days
in a row.
It was genius, mate, actually. Wow. It was a genius move you did there.
With Ben, who films all my videos, with business partners living with me, we just didn't let up. We didn't stop, because it was the opportunity of a lifetime. So I did get like 250,000 new subscribers during that time. Which is massive, isn't it? And I've retained a lot of that audience because they fell in love with that style of content, which I still do. So that's probably... you know, grown, and I've earned money from that. But I did probably make 100 grand from digging up the garden, which is pretty damn cool.
Most people are paying
for
that.
I know it's lame to talk about money, but
interesting though, because it was such a big thing.
Well, I sometimes think it's like there's some responsibility to be honest, isn't there? Because when I was 16 and I was trying to tell my parents this is a career, and they said no, it's not. Well, there wasn't people on podcasts saying you could make 100 grand from digging up the garden. So there we are.
Yeah, I mean, and then how has that been, like the business side of it? Because one of the things that has happened in mountain biking and cycling, and I guess maybe in the world, is that brands have taken notice of saying, oh my God, there's this dude, Matt Jones, who has access to 750,000 people. You know, you've started your own brand. Is the business side something that you enjoy? Like, how has that been to kind of learn that whole side of it?
I actually love it. I'm really, I think about that stuff. That's where a lot of my brain is all the time, yeah. is opportunity. And I think, I don't know if it's my characteristic or from like my whole, from birth or if I've learned it, but I think a lot of people go through life letting opportunities pass them by because they're not looking for them. But I've always been really aware of trying to recognize where those opportunities lay, whether it's meeting somebody or getting in the room with a brand and then you hear them. I need to give examples. So like, for example, if I sat down with a meeting with a sponsor and then I'm listening and I hear someone mention that they're struggling in a certain region, like the north of England, we're not selling many bikes. Like, my brain jumps on that, leaps on it. And then when I come up with a project idea or a marketing campaign or something, I'm aware that we need to push that in that region. So I'll say, right, I'm going to go and film a video up north. That's just an example of where I think I'm always looking for opportunities and things like that. And to grow businesses and try things out, like let's start a clothing company. I did it with Ben, who films all my YouTube stuff. So we're already together all the time. And he's really entrepreneurial in the way he thinks. And we said, let's make a clothing company. We did it right before lockdown. And then I got 250,000 subscribers. That was luck, wasn't it? But then we said, this audience are mountain bikers. Let's make mountain bike jerseys. Let's make trousers. So that's just one part of it. Yeah. Go on, you boys speak. I'm just waffling on
about
it.
No. Good stuff. The thing that I was going to say is, where do you think that athletes, and especially young athletes, make the biggest mistake? Because I think that exactly what you're saying is not how a lot of people really approach what they do as a career.
It's probably their lens is facing the wrong way. They're probably looking out at what they need.
Right.
And whereas actually you need to recognize what companies need and position yourself as the solution to their problems, which are everyone wants to sell things. Everyone wants to tell their boss that they've just started working with someone that can help them sell things. And if you can recognize that and be that person to solve their problems, you're going to climb the ladder. But it helps to be good at something at the start. Like, let's not overlook the fact that I did want to be a pro mountain biker more than anything. And that's been integral to the whole thing. And I still am aware that I need to ride regularly and get better. But so that's like the catalyst that's allowed it all to happen, isn't it?
Well, that's what makes you creditable, isn't it? Right. Against perhaps a lot of other, what you might just call influencers and what have you out there. You know, that's right. You were one of the best. You still are one of the best bike riders in the
cheers,
world.
Cheers, dude.
Yeah. We saw that at Hardline Tasmania.
I got down, didn't I?
Yeah. Actually, no. We were joking about how long it took you to get down. But no, we have been actually a little bit. But in all fairness, to see you ride that track, Matt Jones, slopestyle rider, turn up on a downhill bike at Red Bull Hardline Tasmania and to nail that, to do a race run. That was probably the most impressive thing you've done that I've seen.
Wow.
I thought that was incredible.
Probably because you can relate to it, you understand it. It was tough. That was tough. I found that course so difficult and so hard on my body.
How fast it was. You're normally 30 seconds and sort of 25 mile an hour. That was like wide open and 70, 80 foot gaps. Yeah. You know, it's not really it is your ballpark, but it also isn't, isn't it?
Well, it's the technical stuff, the roots and rock drops that I found so tricky. And then I come around a corner and see a rut that wasn't there 2 hours before and I don't know what to do with it. You know, I haven't faced one of those before. Do you go in that thing to try and avoid it?
You looked great. We were laughing on the broadcast. So for everyone that didn't catch it, there we had Red Bull Hardline is, you know, it's this combination of downhill, some of the most technical downhill in the world with some of the biggest jumps in the world. And it's super physical. All of the World Cup riders were talking about that.
Yeah.
For you, well, one of the things I was looking at, we were talking on the broadcast, is you did some four cross racing back in the day. I caught that.
Yeah.
UK as a wee lad.
Chick sands.
Yeah. What do you think about the different disciplines if you were to kind of think about what makes a rider great? Is it that they can race and do tricks and, you know, be a slopestyle rider, go to somewhere like Rampage, like well-rounded? Because you're one of the only riders in the world that has competed at the level that you're at in so many different disciplines.
Yeah, I'm lucky.
Yeah, it's true.
What makes a good rider? I think they have to start off just riding in the woods and riding jumps on a crappy bike. I think that's so important. The what you can actually recognise the pro riders that kind of grew up that way. They're, you know, like Cade Edwards is just so phenomenally decent at everything. Like you just know, you just know for a fact that he was just sessioning hard on a random bike as a kid. Like, and he had as much fun hopping over tree stumps as he did trying to like ride up a brick wall. You can just see it because it reeks of that. So I think it's the people that weren't shoehorned into a specific discipline straight away that have that can ride anything. Yeah, because and that doesn't mean go. You need to fly to Utah to ride ridgelines, and you need to go to Scotland to ride steep, like rough rock tracks. It actually just means having fun in the woods, kicking in soft turns with your heel, and getting to grips with what a bike can actually do. A basic bike. Yeah, that's what I think. I don't know if that's what you asked, but that's what I think.
Have you ever thought about doing Rampage?
God, I've been there a few times to do some like stuff with Red Bull, just telling the world how mental
it is.
Got
a bike now. You could, well, they're all on slopestyle bikes now anyway, Matt. So it's come back round your way anyway.
The bit that what makes me want to do Rampage more than anything is that you get to build your own line. I love that.
Well, wait. Okay, so you've touched on this a couple of times. And I grew up building jumps. You know, that was the thing that I love. I spend hours and hours every single day building dirt jumps. And I don't know if a lot of people really understand what you mean when you say I'm building jumps. So explain how much of an art it is. Explain, you know, how long it takes and what you're, you know, when you're younger, it's all shovel built. So yeah, give us an overview of what it means to actually build the stuff that you're riding.
Hours and hours and hours of being in your own head, being in the woods on your own. That's what it takes. So how much dirt can you put on the end of a shovel? Like enough to fill your shoes, but you've got to build a takeoff big enough to launch yourself 20 foot in the air to learn to backflip. It's so much dirt. I can't describe when you work with a shovel. So when I was as a teenager, so I was probably like 15, 16, those couple of years, I used to get the train to school in the morning and then get the train back and get off at the next stop where Woburn Trails were, walk up to the woods in my school uniform and then do 50 wheelbarrows up onto the landing I was building five days a week. Yeah, after school. I did that for a while and I drew a tally on the jump, like 5, 10, 15, 20. So I'd just do that on my own and it would take weeks to build a takeoff. And then at weekends was sick because I had loads of help. So many more people were up for it at weekends. But there was a time where I was definitely just on my own, motivated to build jumps, to make landings bigger, to make them softer. So that's what building jumps is. Rampage, they have a time limit and they have to do that, you know? It's really hard work. They have to build it in hard conditions, in the burning heat.
Yeah.
That's what makes Red Bull Rampage special. Everyone watches the riding, but my God, the digging's a huge part of it.
Well, I think that you touched on it too, the creativity of it, and it is so much like art. You had that series Design and Conquer. Can you talk to me, like, how did you come up with this stuff? You did. What was that one thing you did? The backflip, and then land on some
logs,
and then front where does that stuff come from?
Bike flip off one.
Yeah, I don't even know. I don't even know what to call it.
A backflip, and then as I came around the backflip, took my feet off the pedals, and they landed on two upright tree logs with a gap in between. And then as my bike went out, I then forced it down and front flipped off them and made it into a drop. So it was all linked together. I'm not going to lie and say it didn't take 350 attempts to land it over weeks. And that was just like before I'd had tried it with a foam pit and airbag and everything. So it was probably closer
to 1,000. How stressful was that? Like, did it really take weeks? And did it really take 350 goes? I mean, now, you got a film crew there. There's a lot of pressure on you. Someone's created this for you. And you can get hurt at any moment doing that as well, right? I mean, it carries risk.
I felt like I could only do 20 to 30 a day because it was made my legs fatigue so much. Wow. The force of, the top of a log going up through your heels, all the way up through your legs, coming down out from a backflip to then try and compose yourself and stop the bike twisting in half a second to then throw it off. And the number of times I landed on my back or my ass on the drop. But then when you get to the end of the day and it didn't happen, it's not like when you're sessioning as a kid in your local woods, you just go home, have tea and try again the next day. You got to like tell the whole film crew who have been there 6 days, like, oh, we'd probably need to extend this trip and make it seven. She can't go home and see your families, but I will land it tomorrow. I promise. I got so close.
Wow.
And then the next day doesn't happen, you know? And then you're looking at rebooking everything 2 weeks later for the whole crew to come back. So I felt like I carried that stress and that pressure a lot. But it all just, those trick ideas just actually exist in my head. And then when I think of one that I think might work, I visualize doing it loads and then try and build a practice setup to recognize, is this possible? And when I know it is, Red Bull come on board and we go and make it happen. It's, what a thing.
With something like that trick, though, in your, you're saying you could do 30 a day. How do you, after each one, are you assessing how you just did it and, like, do you try and then correct it on the next one or do you just keep going until you get it? Is it like a muscle memory thing and it's going to take that amount of time? Like, what's sort of the process in your head to actually, like, under all that pressure, make it happen, or do you just keep going?
You've got to make micro changes and things to work towards landing it. But it's interesting
it's so
you said
tech,
about muscle memory. When you've done something 300 times wrong, your muscle memory is actually telling your body how to keep doing it badly. So you've got to make massive changes to get away from that habit, because you could go another 1,000 times just doing it wrong. That's actually,
it's hard to realize
all you're getting
that,
good
right,
at.
When you're in it.
All you're practicing is how to crash, and that gets frustrating.
Right.
Yeah, so people say, like, if you're trying a trick and you start crashing at it, just leave it, because you're only going to get more used to crashing it.
Right, that's what you're learning.
True as well, right? That's gnarly, isn't it, when you think about that?
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite video that you've done?
Actually, Frames of Mind, even though it's 7 years old, that was epic. I just got to turn this forest into a mega riding environment and try a load of mad stuff. So that was cool. And it had a loop-the-loop in it, and I can't lie and say that was not like a bucket list item for me to get to ride my bike around a loop-the-loop.
Yeah, I feel like every kid is like, that is actually what I want to do, go around a loop.
They're hard, loop-the-loops.
Backflip, isn't it? If you do a backflip, you've got to just ride it somehow, right?
Even if
it's me sounding like I know what I'm
that's,
doing.
That's what I figured.
And you have to turn a lot. You can't go straight. If you go straight, you come out the top upside down.
Right.
Do you get fed up of all the knocks, Matt? You know, because like you say, you're still out shooting YouTube, you're still knocking yourself about. Do you get tired of being out all the time? Everything you do, you sort of hit the ground at, right?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
It's true, isn't it? That's
my ankles kill the whole time. Only one that really, really bothers me is when I hit my head. I get a real like, oh, that was quite a big one. I can see stars. Like, damn, should I now? Yeah. Is that it for the day? And then you know the answer is yes, but then when you hit your head, you're not in loads of pain. It's not like you rolled your ankle. You can ride more. So that's always a bit of a quandary. But am I tired of all the knocks? Not really. It's all part of it, isn't it?
That's all right. Well, and also, you know, it's interesting to me as well, because you're set up, it seems. You've got this YouTube channel rolling. You are who you are. But you still, like, turned up at Hardline. I know that Marin only just recently made a downhill bike, so you've only recently had that opportunity, but like, you actually came and competed at Red Bull Hardline top to bottom, and I remember asking you, like, I was like, why on earth, Matt, are you doing this, really? Like, you don't need to, because that again is enormously risky.
I can't not, can I, if you get the chance?
You love it, you still love it.
Yeah, I loved that. I loved putting myself out of my comfort zone massively. Yeah, and I loved the frustration of not thinking I could do a drop and then doing it, riding away from it and being like, yes, done that one. Yeah. I am all right. I'm as good as all those other guys that just did that drop. Right, what's next? What's next? What's next? And then suddenly you've done all the features and then you've got to go and link it together and do the whole race run. And that was a bigger challenge again. And then I did that. And I think it was overcoming the mental challenge of thinking I can't do it. Amazing. Everyone should put themselves through that as many times in their life as they can. There is no better feeling than doing something that you felt like was impossible. It's brilliant. Also riding into a finish area again with a load of crowd was sick. Yeah, I haven't totally done that for 5 years. That's a lot of people's
didn't even think about that
job now. I really remember coming off the road gap on the race day and hearing a crowd and thinking, that is a noise that I haven't heard for so long. Yeah, and I had such savage arm pump, but it went away because I was like, I'm there now. I can hear them. Let's get down there. So that was awesome. And I had a son who's just turned one a year ago, and I think it's cool that while he's been alive, I'm going to do some events and bring him along.
Yeah, very cool.
So I can show him some pictures one day to say, look, I still had it when you were alive, mate. Yeah. So they're the reasons. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
I mean, you talk about putting yourself out of your comfort zone. You're a really good presenter and commentator. You've done a lot more of that stuff kind of on the TV side. You've done some stunts. Do you enjoy that side of things?
Yeah. What a life where you get to go to an event. I remember the first time I did a commentary gig. It was with you, Rob. And I remember the bizarre feeling of getting on going to an airport to go to a mountain bike event, a slopestyle event, without my bike.
Just a pen.
I thought, well, this is cool, but I'm also a bit worried. Is this what I'm doing now? Am I going to slopestyle events without a bike? Let's not.
Yeah, weird feeling.
Yeah,
right?
And you'd have remembered it too, Rob, right?
Yeah.
And you, Elliot. We all can sit here and say we've been to like the events that ordinarily we'd be riding in and we didn't even take a bike. Yeah. But I've loved all the opportunities that have come from spiraling off from me just loving biking. We're in a cool spot.
You guys did the Dakar Rally. How was that? I mean, totally outside of bikes and everything.
Next year, apparently, we're doing it side by side. That's the rumor, Matt. Isn't it? Have you heard that rumor? That's the rumor I've heard.
It's not even a rumor anymore. This is now an announcement, everybody. I hear it with good merit that Red Bull would like us to race the Dakar Rally in a side by side.
I think I just signed this and I think that's it done. There we go. Signed on the dotted map. It's coming your way.
Rob and I got to go to Saudi Arabia, a country I don't imagine I'd have ever gone to watch like one of the most unbelievable off-road races ever created. And it was cool, wasn't it? We were actually living in a desert, moving hundreds of miles a day, watching lunatics race over blind over sand dunes at 100 miles an hour
and then turn up to a bunch of lunatics that are their pit crew that basically don't sleep for 3 weeks and just like you'd be in your tent at 3 o'clock in the morning and people will just be outside chatting like it's midday. There is no clock there. It's just mad. It was one of the maddest things I've ever witnessed.
Me too,
definitely.
To dip our toe into that for a week is nuts. It's actually a logistical masterclass that all that can happen. The planning to make that event happen is unreal.
And the fact you can't actually get your head around it until you honestly see the cars in the desert, but on the beautiful images you see everywhere, but what goes behind it is it's absolutely absurd, insane.
We have been lucky, haven't we? Like I'm a professional mountain biker, but that was still part of my job now, was to go and spend some time in Saudi Arabia. Rob and I a few years back went to Africa and stayed with a Maasai tribe and rode our bikes from their village down to a trail. And
what a night that was, Matt.
It was.
With a big chief coming in our mud hut in the middle of the night. He was incredible, wasn't he?
Wearing hard hat and a pair of waders. Because there was a little bit of rain. It was so cool.
Oh my God. It was
For a Red Bull series called Wild Rides. These are the things that I never thought it was going to end up where you get to do this sort of.
And that all comes from biking, which is the maddest thing. And we were all kids that rode our bikes in the woods when we were, that's how it is. That's how it all started. Yeah. Hours and hours, though. Obsessed, really, I was. And I know you were, and I bet you were as well.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
It shows that so few people, even if they claim to have a plan, you don't have a plan, do you? Because where did any of us write down everywhere that before the age of 30, I'd quite like to stay with a Maasai tribe and take my bike along. When the opportunity like reveals itself, it's like, fuck you, let's do that for sure.
What was it like being on the Masters of Air?
Extra on the Spielberg series, Matt Jones?
Crazy. I've not finished, don't ruin it. I've not finished watching that yet, actually.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's good.
Me and Gemma stopped watching it when I went to New Zealand, but we're going to finish that. So I got the chance to do some stuntman work because in that in this big Spielberg series. I'll just repeat the fact it was a Spielberg series that I got the chance to star in. got the chance to do stunt work. They had a scene where they want a load of World War II bikes in a mess to have this race. And at the end, there's a huge pile-up. So we spent at least 7 days on a film set rehearsing. All in full, legit World War II uniform, all hair done like a soldier back then. It was so cool. And these bikes were genuinely built in the 30s and 40s. They're nearly, they're 80, 90-year-old bikes. They're not replicas. There was a whole team of mechanics just trying to keep these old relics running for us to crash into each other. And it was cool, so cool. I got to be a stuntman, and then when we watched the second episode, I'm right there next to the main guy on TV. All because I was recognised to be appropriately good enough on a bike to have a massive over the bars. I don't know if that's I actually got paid to crash for once. Funny, eh?
Did that give you any ideas for your stuff? You're just like, little Spielberg trick, coming to the YouTube channel, no stress.
No, I don't know what I could take from that. It's the production, the way they make those movies is unbelievable. There's like this steel girder that stuck out a bit of the wall, right? That we had to race underneath, and we weren't wearing helmets because no one had worn helmets back then. And a few of us were worried that we might clip our head on it. So you tell like the art director that, we're worried about that steel girder. Then you come back the next day, it's been removed and replaced with 100% like-for-like steel girder that's made of foam. You wouldn't be able to notice the difference.
So like,
overnight they're like carving polystyrene and painting it. And you wouldn't, they do the same with brick walls. Someone said, if you low side round that flat corner, someone's going to hit a brick wall and things, and it would be bad, and it will break the bike, and the lead actor might get hurt. Come back the next day, it's now made of foam, but it looks identical.
That's mad.
That's actually insane.
So we were doing that for 7-8 days, and it amounts to maybe a 20-second scene in a movie.
It's pretty incredible, isn't it? Eh? Yeah. Resources on another
same budget, huh?
Yeah, Matt. Yeah, different again, isn't it?
So Matt, I mean, you've kind of feel like living, like cracked the code, because most of your work now is from home. You have a family now.
McLaren.
on the farm. I mean, what has that been like, I guess, just having your son there, being able to work from home, if you would call it that. I don't think it's Zoom calls every day. But tell me about the farm, the home life.
It's epic. This whole plan to buy a farm and move to a farm was to build jumps and have more space to build jumps, just to continue that dream. And I've done that. I've built a set of trails. We built a skate park in a barn. I've built 2 pit bike tracks. It's like really going.
I'm coming over.
Rob's on the way.
I'll be there soon.
So it keeps me really, really, really busy. And then I live with, my fiance, my son Cove, 4 stepkids. We've got 3 horses, 3 peacocks, chickens, a dog. It's mad. It's every day is insane.
You've got 3 horses.
A peacock. Yeah. What is a peacock?
Like
do?
A bird with that big feather.
No, I know what it is, but like, what's
loud.
The point? What do you? Like,
I didn't want
why?
Them. They came with the house. The bloke who sold me the house said, if we take these peacocks away, they'll try and find their way back to where they were born, which is here. So I said,
they're yours for life.
So I said, mate, that's absolutely fine. Thank you so much. We'll definitely have the peacocks. And within a week, we realised why he didn't want them. They are so loud.
Are they really?
Yeah, well, they're good guard animals, actually. They honk when anyone comes up the drive. So,
I don't know. Are they vicious? Do they bite? Should I be scared of peacocks?
No, you shouldn't. Yeah, they're fine. I mean, when they actually fly, they're massive. They're like pterodactyls.
They fly? Yeah. Peacocks don't fly.
Oh, yeah, they like block out the sun when they fly over the house. It's insane, I swear.
What, like sort of a Game of Thrones, like a dragon coming into land?
Yeah, it's like
King's Landing.
Yeah. It's exactly like King's Landing. So, life's definitely got crazy and wild, but I've got space to build things, and that was the whole point. Yeah. So I can't wait for the ground to dry out so I can keep building stuff.
Yeah, because you're not someone who likes to relax, are you? You want to wake up in the morning. You need a full day ahead of you, I think. I think that's how you like it.
Yeah. I moan about it sometimes, but I think, yeah, I wouldn't, if someone said to me, you're not doing anything tomorrow, I'd quite quickly find ways of filling a day. Yeah. We must all be like that, because otherwise you wouldn't stick with anything, you know?
Right. Yeah. No. Do you want your son to follow your path as well?
I mean, I'm not going to stop him, but he could do whatever. Hopefully he doesn't get into horses. They're a lot of work.
Can you ride a horse?
I can just about, yeah. But that riding something that's got a mind of its own is like ridiculous.
Boy, they're lethal, yeah, mate.
You want them to go left, they go right. You want them to stop and they want to run as fast as they physically can.
It's
I got on one in Ecuador. I hadn't been on one before ever. And one, its mate trotted off in front. And then this one's like, just picks up speed. And I'm freaking out on the back of it. And mate, he's like, they're a pack animal. And I'm like, I don't care. It's like, it's completely out of control. It just trotted off up this hill with me. Like, I was passenger. I had no, it was gnarly.
It would have recognised your weakness as well, Rob.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, apparently. Yeah. Cool. Luckily, my feet could touch down each side of it. So it wasn't too bad.
It wasn't a horse. It was like a donkey or something. I always think that they're like motocross bikes with a mind of their own, where the throttle can get stuck.
Oh, they're dangerous things, in my opinion. I mean, not saying I don't like horses. They're a beautiful creature, but I don't want to be on the back of one. Do you know what I mean?
I just want to see them from afar.
Yeah, pat one. Give it some grass with a perfectly flat hand and a carrot.
They're a lot
and you're
bigger not, than you think.
You're not holding anything solid. We're so used to holding a pair of bars. You're holding these like two little
flimsy
strings. What's that? How can you support your weight with that? You can't. That doesn't make sense. If I could put a set of good handlebars on a horse, I think I'd be a good rider.
Yeah, I agree with you. So you should get a bit of leverage on.
Can you please do a YouTube video of a horse with handlebars?
Yeah, Gemma keeps telling me it won't work, but I'm going to do some mods.
Yeah, just 3D print some sort of neck thing and stick a set of handlebars on it. I think it'll work.
Yeah. All right, watch it. Give me 3 months.
I love it. I'm just going to see a thumbnail of a horse head, Matt Jones, and then somebody like falling off.
Probably.
Or something like that.
It'd be good.
Oh, man. And Matt, I also want to touch on your brother, Jono.
Yeah.
I mean, you guys grew up riding together. I mean, he raced the World Cups and, you know, now he's in the corporate world. He didn't escape. But what has that been like? I mean, he's still in the scene. He does some presenting and stuff like that.
I know. Jono's like very well loved in the mountain bike world. He's a seriously funny guy.
Yeah.
And it was probably not fair that I didn't mention him at the start of the podcast, actually, because I can't think of anything more integral to my interest in the sport from a young age and having an identical twin brother that shared that interest.
Yeah.
Someone who's the same age, pretty much the same build, same height, riding the same bike. I mean, my mum and dad bought two identical BMXs for us, one red, one green. So, like, if you want to compete against someone and it be fair competition, you don't get more even Stevens than a twin, do you? So, it was good. It was a good way of staying competitive from a young age in a healthy way. You know, we just wanted to be better than each other, and that was quite, you know, you quite quickly climb.
You never, like me and my brother, he raced, he was really competitive, and I've never spoke to him since, you know, even though it was like 20 years ago.
But
you and Jono were pretty, you stayed pretty close all the way through it. You're tight, aren't you?
Yeah, in the four cross days when we actually raced head to head, we were on the start gate together, we'd argue quite a lot, naturally. But bizarrely, he's always been interested in going fast and racing downhill. Ultimately, that's where you end up. And I've liked doing tricks and jumping.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When we went skiing together once with the school, he just wanted to do straight line bombs top to bottom, and I quite like dicking around in the woods trying to find little jumps. I think it's how our brains work differently. So we actually haven't, throughout our careers, haven't spent a great deal of time competing against each other. However, Red Bull Hardline this year in Wales, we'll be back head to head again potentially.
Oh, no way.
Who knows? Well, I want to race it, so does he, but let's see.
Jones.
You told me that.
Oh, yeah,
you
we're
told
the
me that apparently Jono was riding, so you worded it so that you definitely got a ride and Jono got a ride.
Well, you text me, you're interested in Hardline. I said, I'll only do it if Jono's on the list.
That's right. And then you said that, you said that someone said it's fine. So I was like, okay then.
Yes.
Just got to get clarification, it's over.
Is that confirmed?
Well, you're the director of sport.
All right, you're in.
Yeah.
I folded up. You and Jono. But we need it, don't we? We need this race. It's like the race within a race at Hardline.
Yeah.
True. I mean, he's going to smash me. I don't even know why we're hyping up. He's going to put a minute into me.
the battle of the century right here.
Red Bull have to assess whether or not they can afford the TV satellite time to put me on a track like that.
Yeah, right. Oh, man, Matt, this has been great. I feel like I'm sure you have, like, so many other projects going through your head. Like, what does the future look like for you?
Stick to my core and my roots of trying to push the limits of what I can do on my bike. And I think I've done a good job so far this year. Went to Darkfest and rode some 1,900-foot jumps. Then off to Tasmania and raced one of the hardest tracks in the world. When the ground dries up here, I'm going to be digging flat out, building more jumps, training on my airbag. There's some tricks I want to learn. So that's my year ahead. And then keep trying to make cool mountain bike clothes with Hellfair. YouTube videos are central to everything, so the whole thing gets documented on that. And then and I'm also planning on building we've started the process of building a Xbox PlayStation mountain bike game. So
no way. Yeah. Wow. Is it like Matt Jones specific?
No, but I'm gonna make sure it's like the best game it can be as a pro mountain biker. I'll make sure it plays like real life.
That is,
yeah,
so cool.
So there we are, lots of things going on.
Never not busy. Yeah. Never not busy.
It's just to say, I don't know, it's just an opportunity that I kind of sensed was there and went after it. So now I'm doing it. So that's cool.
Yeah. No, good. That's what you do, though. You create, you know, that's what you've made your own, you've created your own lifestyle. You've made it happen. And you know, to do it to the level you have is incredible. Like, not everyone tries, not many get there.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's good for us to have people like you in the sport to like show what is possible, like you said, yeah, where you can be a YouTube, you can be on YouTube, you can create your own brand, yeah, you can start projects, you can be an entrepreneur. And I think that's like, it's something that's really important, not just for young people to have, but also for the current professionals to have somebody to look.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think a few years ago when I started to kind of break free from the standard route of just doing competitions and getting sponsors, and like I had this more business mentality, when it started to work and I was making more money from it, I felt a little bit embarrassed because I don't know. Sure. You kind of think like, oh, maybe it is embarrassing, isn't it, just being like, well, maybe slightly successful.
We grew up in competition, and so I think that when you like, it almost feels like the pinnacle a lot of the times is like, okay, I win, and that is like what you almost have this imposter syndrome or whatever.
Yeah, that's what I felt.
Outside of...
But now I think it's swung 180, and I feel a duty to kind of actually just be honest and talk about it and help motivate people to not miss out on those moments in life where you can find a fork in the road and go off and do something cool and new and innovative. So yeah, I'm actually glad we touched on it, for sure. You boys need to come to the farm. Rob, you're back in the UK soon, I'm sure. I want you to come ride pit bikes.
In a week's time, and I'm coming over, definitely, to ride the sand track.
And Elliot, you come sometime this year, and I'll show you what a peacock is.
That'll be great. I'll keep my distance, but...
You sure they fly? I'm sure they fly. I don't think they do.
I promise they soar through the air.
Matt Jones, this has been so cool. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks, Matt.
Nice one, boys. Legend.
Rob, this was... I'm really happy we got to do this one. I think that there's... Matt is one of those new school kind of modern athletes who is, after his competitive career, he's gone on to do almost bigger and better things.
On his own.
Yeah.
He's much more than an athlete.
Right.
That's right. And I mean, you could, like he said, he still says correctly that he is a professional bike rider. Yeah. He isn't an influencer or a YouTuber, but and he's right. But the way he is on a bike and the way that he still rides his bike and still progresses, he's not resting on his laurels. He still pushes it out there. He still takes massive risks and goes forwards with it. Then that just makes him absolutely credible. And might be why he's so successful.
Totally. I mean, I think too, like he talks about his work ethic, and I thought it was really nice the way that he highlighted the way that he kind of works with brands and thinking about the other person, the person on the other side of the deal, the person on the other side of the camera. I think that's why his videos have been so good, is because he thinks about, well, what would I not only what can I bring and what would I want to do? I love building, but also what would somebody want to watch? What would I want to watch as a kid or something like that?
Yeah. I mean, he's just brilliant. He's a brilliant bike rider and a brilliant businessman. We didn't really talk just about how successful he is, he's massively successful at what he does.
Yeah.
You know, and but at the core of it, he's just a mountain bike rider, which is the coolest thing, really.
For sure.
Yeah.
Well, of course, we know that you know the drill by now. If you want to get in touch with us, suggest a guest, let us know how you're feeling, your thoughts about anything, hit us up on social or at podcast@redbull.com.
And don't forget, every other Tuesday, there is a new episode of Just Ride Out. It's available to listen wherever you get your podcast. And if you want to watch us too, you can check the full length episodes on redbull.com and Red Bull TV.
There we go.
Bosh.
See you next time.
You will. See you then. Bye.